its strange epidemiology, because of its strange symptomology, or whatever you call it, might possibly be some kind of biological warfare weapon that has either been accidentally or purposefully allowed to get out into the general populace. And we're going to be examining that possibility tonight and looking at all the various reasons that that might be so, as well as entertaining the possibility that it might not. And anyway, so that's just to give you a general rundown. It's going to be a rather interesting show. It will be technical in places, but since neither Dave nor myself are qualified medical folk, we're going to do our best to put it in the simplest possible terms, because that's what we need to understand it ourselves. And we will endeavor to make it all as interesting and listenable as possible.
Okay, and by the way, if anybody has, for some reason, is unable to record this broadcast, all of our archive shows, all 15 of the Radio Free America shows to date, all four of our Guns of November shows about the assassination of President Kennedy, are available from a tape duplication service that we will tell you about at the end of the broadcast. And again, the reason that we're putting all of this information together is so that people can have sort of a radio document, I guess you can say, can have all of this information assembled in one place at one time, because a lot of people have called us up and requested, you know, asked us where we could get information of this type. Well, this is why we're collating all of the information on AIDS that we've put together to date and getting it all in one spot for your convenience.
Indeed. And again, just to let you know, you don't have to feel, you can be very interested in this stuff and not be able to sit and listen through an entire broadcast of this sort. We realize this is why the archive broadcasts are put together, because that way we don't have to go back and cover all the information when these subjects come up during the regular shows, which have, not only we cover a variety of topics in any one show, but there's much more of a give and take with the audience. We're answering questions, we're listening to things that people have to say or call in to offer to us. And we don't want to have to go over everything in detail. So these, again, they're archive broadcasts. You can think of it almost as being sort of an audio tape library that you can put together if you want to. Not that we consider our words to be deathless, but because a great deal of work and preparation has gone out into compiling this material, and many of them are from sources that are rather difficult to get a hold of, although whenever possible we do try and use sources that are available to everybody. And it is therefore of use, even if you can't listen to it all the way through tonight, to sit down and maybe spend half an hour or 40 minutes listening to it, and then another chunk later on and so forth. However is most fitting for you and the way that that you can handle this kind of material. Again, we realize this is fairly heavy-duty stuff, but we think it's also extremely vital stuff, very important. And if indeed, as a couple medical men will suggest in the information that we're going to give you tonight, if indeed AIDS is some form of biological warfare weapon, considering the incredible mortality rate and the incredible brutal cynicism and cruelty of the people who would use such a thing, I think it's in all our best interests to understand that possibility.
Last word before we get rolling here. Unlike most of the other archive broadcasts, this program is somewhat speculative in nature. Obviously, we have not got the smoking gun with regard to AIDS as being a biological warfare weapon. However, there is a very nasty body of circumstantial evidence pointing increasingly in that direction, and that's what we're going to be presenting this evening. Again, most of the broadcast, it's simply a question of recapping history, albeit history that most people are unfamiliar with. This broadcast, we're looking ahead as well as back, and we're attempting to get a line on what certainly would appear to be as just about as great a crisis as there is in the world today, and one which is affecting a lot of people here in the Bay Area, one which may be affecting a whole lot of other people in the future. And as Nip Tuck said, our words are not deathless. However, neither are human beings, and given the circumstances that we're talking about here, it figures that these non-deathless human beings are going to become highly mortal in the future if things continue at the present pace.
Okay, the first selection that we're going to read tonight is from a book called A Higher Form of Killing, The Secret Story of Chemical and Biological Warfare. The book is written by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman, Paxman. It's copyrighted 1982, Hill and Wang, New York, a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
And what we're going to be doing to begin the broadcast, the first part of the broadcast, is basically we're going to present a thumbnail synopsis of certain key features of the American Chemical and Biological Warfare Development Program, also some of the key features of the British program, by way of setting the historical background and some of the context in which we feel AIDS should be seen.
Indeed. Now, the first section that we're reading from A Higher Form of Killing is concerned with the time in the late 1940s and early 1950s, where much of the policy for what the, for the present day state of affairs in biological and chemical warfare research was being set, again, in the aftermath of World War II. In the United States, the authors write, where nearly 4,000 people had been employed at the four top secret germ warfare installations by the end of the war, staff levels were initially reduced. But the man who had led American research into germ weapons during the Second World War, George W. Merck, M-E-R-C-K, of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company, recommended that the work continue. Camp Dietrich, spelled D-E-T-R-I-C-K, the former National Guard airfield an hour's drive from Washington, was chosen for the purpose. The true nature of Camp Dietrich's work during the war had been so well concealed that local people knew little or nothing about what went on there. One local rumor was that the place, with its tall chimneys, was being used for the extermination of prisoners. Over the coming years, the scientists at Camp Dietrich and Portendown is the British equivalent of Camp Dietrich, the place where the British Biological Warfare Research Center was located. Over the coming years, the scientists at Camp Dietrich and Portendown would investigate almost every known fatal disease. While most would not be tested on humans, the Western researchers were nevertheless able to base much of their work upon a compendium of case studies which supposedly did not exist. The obsession with germ warfare, which developed in the post-war years, soon led to disregard for legal scruples. As we have seen, the Soviet authorities did attempt to bring charges against the Japanese officers responsible for the hideous human experiments conducted at field stations in occupied China. It might have been expected that similar charges would be laid against Japanese military biologists captured by the Americans. But, in an extraordinary decision, which was to remain secret for 30 years, the Americans offered immunity from prosecution if, in exchange, the Japanese would hand over details of their experiments on prisoners of war. Initially, the Americans had been skeptical of reports that the Japanese had tested their biological weapons on human beings. Early reports from Far East headquarters suggested that they were too unreliable to be taken seriously. When members of MacArthur's staff questioned General Ishishiro, the founder of the notorious Unit 731 and the leader of the Japanese germ warfare program, he produced the standard answer of military biologists the world over. Research had indeed been conducted, but purely as a means of defense against possible enemy attack. Since Ishii's staff had destroyed their biological warfare plants and murdered surviving human guinea pigs in the days immediately preceding the Soviet occupation of Manchuria, American investigators could not lay their hands on firm evidence to disprove the claim. But from the evidence they uncovered during their advance into Manchuria, the Russians concluded that Ishii was lying. They requested permission from the Americans to interview him and other military bacteriologists being held by the United States. Legal advisors in Washington took the view that the Russians had no legal basis for their request, but that it might be considered a friendly gesture to allow them to do so. Beforehand, however, the Japanese were to be interrogated again by American biological warfare specialists. This time, the investigation yielded results. In May 1947, Ishii, frightened by the possibility of being handed over to the Russians, dramatically changed his story and admitted to his interrogators that the Japanese had conducted, quote, field trials with anthrax weapons against the Chinese. Nevertheless, the majority of the allegations against Ishii and his former colleagues remain no more than hearsay and rumor. In the opinion of several of the legal advisors, they did not constitute the basis for war crime charges. Clearly, the question of whether the charges could be made to stand up in court influenced Washington's decision on whether or not to prosecute the Japanese. But by the time this was being considered, the investigation itself was operating in a hazy area in which the demands of justice were being balanced against possible propaganda and intelligence gains. In particular, the Pentagon wished to consider a proposal General Ishii made during interrogation. According to a top-secret memorandum transmitted to Washington by cable on May 6, 1947, quote, Ishii states that if guaranteed immunity from war crimes, in documentary form for himself, superiors, and subordinates, he can describe the germ warfare program in detail. To assess the value of Ishii's information, the Pentagon sent two senior biologists from Camp Dietrich to Japan. Dr. Edwin V. Hill and Dr. Joseph Victor arrived in Tokyo on October 28th and began their investigations with vigor. On December 12, 1947, they reported that they had interviewed no less than 19 Japanese biological warfare specialists. They had discovered that the Japanese had investigated an enormous array of diseases, including anthrax, plague, tuberculosis, smallpox, typhoid, and cholera. A number of Japanese admitted that they had tested potential germ weapons on human beings. The American biologists were clearly stunned by the information. The scale of the research far exceeded any tests conducted by the Allies during the war, not only in the range of diseases, but also in the accounts of how particular ailments affected their victims. The Japanese had not only deliberately infected prisoners with disease, but had, quote, sacrificed selected cases during their experiments in order to discover the effects of the diseases at different stages. The experiments were as horrific as any conducted by the Nazis, yet the Camp Dietrich specialists dispassionately concluded in their summary of the report of biological warfare investigations of December 12, 1947, that the potential benefits of the research for the Western biological warfare program far outweighed the demands of justice. If the Japanese were to be questioned by the Russians, then they, rather than the Americans, would obtain the benefits of wartime research. Their concluding recommendation read as follows, quote, "Evidence gathered in this investigation has greatly supplemented and amplified previous aspects of this field. It represents data which have been acquired by Japanese scientists at the expenditure of many millions of dollars and years of work. Information is accrued with respect to human susceptibility to these diseases, as indicated by specific infectious doses of bacteria. Such information could not be obtained in our own laboratories because of scruples attached to human experimentation. These data were acquired with a total outlay of $250,000 to date, a mere pittance by comparison with the actual cost of the studies. It is hoped that individuals who voluntarily contributed this information will be spared embarrassment because of it, and that every effort will be made to prevent this information falling into other hands." Unquote. This concern to spare the Japanese doctors possible embarrassment found a ready response in Washington, where, in order to maintain a lead over Soviet plans for germ warfare, the full extent of American knowledge of Japanese wartime plans was kept secret for 30 years. Okay, a couple of things I wanted you to know. Since we have the actual words of these doctors sent out from the Pentagon, a couple of key things. Again, to think about the mindset of the people involved already at this stage. It was interesting that the choice of words, this is officialese at its most sinister. Information has accrued with respect to human susceptibility to these diseases. Okay, think about that. Information has accrued. No human involvement whatsoever, just accrued the way that water accrues in a puddle. In other words, what they're doing there is, that's officialese for people have been injected with diseases and died horribly and we want to benefit from it. And then in the following paragraphs, they're talking about that the data has been acquired with a total outlay of $250,000, meaning by the United States to find this out, a mere pittance by comparison with the actual cost. And then at the end, they talk about wanting to spare the people who voluntarily contributed this information embarrassment. Now again, I just think as the author makes the point, what if this had been the Nazis talking about what they found out? What about Mengele? What he found out, in the prison camps at the prison labs at Auschwitz about, you know, how long it took people to die when you cut pieces of their body off, and they wanted to spare Mengele the embarrassment of having made this information public.
Regrettably, so many of the Nazi war criminals received similar treatment. They were ushered in and given the red carpet treatment in exchange for their expertise.
Indeed.
As we've talked about at great length on these Radio Free America broadcasts vis-a-vis the Galen Organization.
Absolutely, but with very few of these Nazi war criminals, with the exception of Frank Wisner's Russians, have we seen gotten to see the actual documents involved where they're talking in this, again, as the authors put it, dispassionate tone. I think cynical might be a better word than dispassionate. Anyway, but the key point that we want to make here is that is Ishishiro and the Japanese biological warfare people. conducting human experimentation, as is not mentioned directly in this article, among other things, on American GIs being held in prisoner of war camps. The information was hushed up among the people apparently on that team, who has not too far in the distant past held a rather important public office. Alexander Haig was one of the people involved in the early days with making these connections between the occupation forces of America and the Japanese biological warfare weapons researchers. And Alexander Haig was almost certainly one of the people who was keeping this secret for 30 years from the American people and the families of the servicemen who probably died in these laboratories at the hands of General Ishii and his cohorts. So right away from the very beginning, we have, as Dave pointed out, as we've talked about so many times with the importation of the Galen Organization into the United States, instead of the loathing that any average American feels about this, we have a very calm, very cynical America basically importing the absolute worst and most disgusting excesses of fascism into the United States and incorporating them directly into our system, in this case, directly into our chemical and biological warfare programs.
Okay, now again, one of the things about Unit 731 is that it represented a key stage in the development of U.S. biological and chemical warfare programs, as with the Galen Organization, which to a considerable extent set the tone not only for the Cold War, but also for the development of the U.S. intelligence system. Unit 731, I guess you could say, sounded a keynote with regard to the future of U.S. biological warfare development. Now, before leaving Unit 731, keep in mind Nip's statement about Alexander Haig, who at the time was serving as a lieutenant on General MacArthur's staff in Japan. And in fact, in Radio Free America show number 11, I guess it was number 13, we talked about Alexander Haig and how he married into the MacArthur staff, I guess you could say. His wife is the daughter of General Alonzo Fox, a key MacArthur aide. We looked at the MacArthur Group, their evolution from the Morgan Group in our Aryan Nations series, and it's worth taking a look here, I think, very briefly in order to sort of understand some of the historical continuity between some of the events that we talk about in these programs. It's worth taking a look at a key person, as well as General as Alexander Haig, who actually was relatively minor but was involved with this whole kit and caboodle here, to look at a key person with regard to the importation of Unit 731. Going to read a short section from an article that appeared in the This World magazine that comes with the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. This from the This World of November 3rd, 1985. It's an article headlined, "The Human Guinea Pigs, Japanese Army Doctors Killed 3,000 POWs in Biological Warfare Experiments." And it, as it mentions, as Nip mentioned, some of these POWs were Americans. Reading now a key name involved with the importation of Unit 731. Harumi Ishii, General Ishii's eldest daughter, who served as her father's secretary during his interrogations by U.S. investigators, has told of entertaining American officers during their talks with her father. Among the dinner guests at the Ishii home was Major General Charles A. Willoughby, General Douglas MacArthur's chief of intelligence. Dr. Murray Sanders, a former lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps and one of the early investigators sent to Japan, has described a private meeting between himself, Willoughby, and MacArthur. "The Japanese were stalling. Assurances of safety from unknown officials in Washington were not enough. They wanted something better. Willoughby asked if Sanders could give Ishii MacArthur's promise of immunity from war crimes charges. MacArthur, Saunders states, gave his nod of sanction. Unlike their German counterparts who were tried as war criminals or who became the objects of worldwide manhunts, the Japanese doctors received immunity and were able to use their war-developed skills in civilian life." And of course, Charles Willoughby, as we've seen, was a doctrinaire fascist, originally born Karl Adolf Wiedenbach, educated at the Krieg at the German Military Academy, and who, while at the West Point, lectured on the virtues of Francisco Franco, the Hitler protege who was Willoughby's idol. So it's not really all that surprising to see Charles Willoughby sanctioning, and eventually he actually signed the papers affecting the transfer of Unit 731 to the United States, and specifically, Unit 731 was brought to Camp Dietrich, or Fort Dietrich, which is was, and apparently, as we're going to take a look, may very well still be the U.S.'s, the top American Chemical and Biological Warfare Research Center. So again, bear in mind that one of the key people from the MacArthur staff, as well as MacArthur himself, Charles Willoughby from our Aryan Nation series, a key person with regard to bringing in Unit 731.
Now, those of you who are of a skeptical frame of mind may be out there saying, well, yes, but the Cold War was on, and, you know, we just decided, well, it's too late, the information has already been gotten, you know, these poor people have already died, all of the breast-beating and knee-jerk liberal mouthings in the world won't bring them back to life, and we might as well use the information against the evil scourge of the Soviet Union. But Americans wouldn't do anything like that, you see, so that's the difference. We're just using the information just like you wouldn't cut down a tree, but once the tree's cut down, you might as well make a fire. Well, we're going to examine that theory a little bit.
Of course, once you've got a fire and it begins to burn down, you need more fuel to keep the flames high.
Indeed, indeed. And the Americans had developed a liking for that kind of fire. The book we're reading from, again, is A Higher Form of Killing. They're talking now about the era, the same era again, immediately after World War II, directly after the importation of Project 731 into the United States. While these tests showed the relative, they're talking about tests now carried out in the Bahamas by the British people at Porton Down.
To which we're going to be coming back later in the broadcast.
While these tests showed the relative virulence of the diseases under examination, they did not solve the central problem of how easy it would be to attack a large city or military base. Experiments with harmless bacteria soon after the war had shown how easy it was for germs to penetrate the interior of a sealed ship, but now attacks were needed against civilian targets. Over the next two decades, there would be over 200 experiments in the United States alone in which military and civilian targets, including whole cities, would be attacked with imitation biological weapons. The tests were conducted in total secrecy. If inquisitive officials asked questions, they were told the Army was conducting experiments with smoke screens to protect the city from radar detection. The targets of the attacks ranged from isolated rural communities to entire cities, including New York and San Francisco. One of the earliest experiments took place in San Francisco in 1950. The Pentagon believed it might be possible for a Soviet submarine to slip into an American harbor, release a cloud of bacteria, and disappear before the victims of the attack had even begun reporting to hospital. San Francisco, the headquarters of the 6th Army and much of the Pacific Fleet, seemed a likely target for such an attack. Between the 20th and 26th of September in 1950, the theory was tested by two U.S. Navy minesweepers steaming up and down outside the Golden Gate Bridge. On board the naval vessel's crewmen released clouds of a spray contaminated with Bacillus globigi and Serratia marasesens, two supposedly harmless bacteria. The Serratia marasesens, codenamed 8UK, had been developed at Porton Down, again that's the British location, during the Second World War because when it incubated it turned red, making it very easily identifiable when used in biological warfare attacks. There were six mocked attacks on the city. In their report later, the scientists concluded that 117 square miles of the San Francisco area had been contaminated, and that almost everyone in the city had inhaled the bacteria. Quote, in other words, they wrote, nearly every one of the 800,000 people in San Francisco exposed to the cloud at normal breathing rate inhaled 5,000 or more particles. Any other area having a steady wind and a degree of atmospheric stability comparable to San Francisco is vulnerable to a similar type of attack, and there are many such areas in the U.S. and elsewhere. The point had been proved. But the San Francisco test was only one of many. In 1951, American Navy personnel deliberately contaminated 10 wooden boxes with Serratia marasesens, Bacillus globigi, and Aspergillus fumigatus before they were shipped from a supply depot in Pennsylvania to the Navy base in Norfolk, Virginia. The tests were designed to establish how easily disease might be spread among the people employed to handle the boxes at the supply depot. Of the three infectious bacteria, Aspergillus fumigatus had been specifically chosen because black workers at the base would be particularly susceptible to it.
Okay, a couple of key points to underscore about the passage Nip just read you. First of all, that the tradition of experimenting on live human subjects, which we saw, of course, with Unit 731, the Japanese biological warfare unit, which was ensconced at Camp Dietrich, Fort Dietrich, after the conclusion of World War II, that we found that this tradition continued on with the American biological warfare program itself, as well as the British, namely the practice of testing agents of various kinds on unwitting civilian populations. Now, the tests referred to here are supposedly harmless. It should be known that the Serratia Marcescens, in this very famous experiment in San Francisco Bay, that a man died of, an elderly man died of Serratia infection. There was a very highly publicized lawsuit where this man's family sued the U.S. government. They were defeated. It should be known, though, it should be noted that in the Bay Area, Serratia infection is a leading cause of death to this day among senior citizens. People with normal, healthy immune systems are not affected. However, senior citizens, people with weakened immune systems, are vulnerable to a sometimes fatal infection by Serratia, one of the highest incidences of which is right here in the Bay Area. It should be noted, again, that the practice of experimenting on human subjects here became a key feature of the U.S. biological warfare program. And again, to move outside of the biological warfare framework here just for a second, a very famous set of experiments was done during the same time period in which GIs in the military were marched up to very, very close proximity to nuclear tests, being told at the time that these were perfectly harmless. Then when these men turned up with solid cancers and leukemias, some of them 20 and 25 years later, they were basically told, TS by the government, prove it and we'll pay you, otherwise hit the road. So it's the assertions that these tests are harmless here should be taken with a rather generous grain of salt. Also, it should be noted, too, as in the last experiment here, where a number of boxes were contaminated at a supply depot in order to affect black workers at the Navy depots where these boxes were being loaded and unloaded, indicates a thing which, again, another trend which we're going to be seeing for quite some time with regard to the U.S. program, and which should be noted in particular with regard to AIDS, namely the habit of our biological warfare people of targeting particular sections of a population, in other words, a particular ethnic or racial group, a group of people who are a group of people whose distinguishing feature would be their sexual practices, cultural groups, and so forth, because the practice of targeting a particular segment of a population group became, just like human experimentation, a tradition in the U.S. biological warfare program, as we're going to see, and of course also in, or with regard to the AIDS infection, looking ahead, where we have in this country intravenous drug users, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and people of that kind being targeted, whereas in Africa it's a heterosexual disease, raises some questions about possibly how this particular disease happens to be affecting certain kinds of people. Now, with regard to human experimentation, again, the both ethno-specific experimentation, I guess you could say, and with regard to knowingly killing people for scientific or allegedly scientific purposes, this too, unfortunately, is a tradition which not only was strengthened by the importation of Unit 731, but which existed in this country before that. A very famous experiment is the so-called Tuskegee experiment, in which a bunch of black men in the rural South during the 1930s were infected with syphilis and then monitored for a number of years, in fact almost 40 years, without being told about their illness or being treated. An article about the Tuskegee experiment appeared in the New York Times of February 6, 1975. This is a UPI story, Dateline Montgomery headline, $37,500 is awarded for each survivor of syphilis project. The federal government has approved a settlement of $37,500 for each survivor in a government-sponsored syphilis experiment in Macon County, Alabama, court records showed today. The out-of-court settlement apparently terminated a $1.8 billion suit filed on behalf of participants in a 40-year-old study of untreated syphilis among black males in the Alabama county. Skipping down in the article, at least 28 persons died in the study, begun by the United States Public Health Service in 1932 and halted in 1972. The suit said that officials had failed to administer penicillin to those with syphilis after researchers discovered in 1946 that the drug was an effective cure. for syphilis. So again, human experimentation, although it was strengthened by Unit 731, did not begin then. Human experimentation in this country with regard to biological warfare weapons has been known to deliberately sacrifice human life, as in this case. And again, there has been a particular emphasis on targeting or experimenting with particular ethnic or social groups, in other words, particular segments of a population.
With that thought in mind, we're going to return to the book, A Higher Form of Killing, and learn a little bit more about this particular, as Dave put it, ethno-specific targeting of biological warfare weapons. Man's increasing understanding of the delicate mechanism which makes life possible may also solve the problem of how to design a weapon which will kill an enemy while leaving friendly troops unharmed. In particular, military scientists might rekindle their interest in, quote, ethnic weapons, designed to affect only selected racial groups. An American military manual noted the possibility in 1975, quote, "It is theoretically possible to develop so-called ethnic chemical weapons, which would be designed to exploit naturally occurring differences in vulnerability among specific population groups. Thus, such a weapon would be capable of incapacitating or killing a selected enemy population to a significantly greater extent than the population of friendly forces," unquote. Many of these naturally occurring differences are well known, the authors write. The inability of the digestive systems of particular racial groups to cope with the food of another group, for example. But the differences go further. In the United States, where most of the research has been conducted, it has been established that within the American Indian population, 95% of Cherokee Indians have type O blood, while 85% of Blackfeet Indians have type A blood. It is reasonable to suppose that other similar differences occur among less advanced societies. Certainly, during the Vietnam War, the so-called, quote, Advanced Projects Research Agency, an elite group of scientists working for the Pentagon, was employed to carry out blood tests on selected groups of Asians with a view to, quote, preparing a map portraying the geographic distribution of human blood groups and other inherited blood characters, unquote. The Pentagon claimed the project was solely to establish the food requirements of American and Allied troops.
So again, the focus of American biological warfare programs of attempting to develop diseases that would affect particular sections of a population group and leave the other sections of the population untouched is, again, that's a major feature of the U.S. biological warfare program. And again, with regard to AIDS, in which we see homosexuals and intravenous drug users, Caribbean and African blacks, and whereas it appears to be primarily a homosexual ailment in this country, it is primarily a heterosexual ailment in Africa. And again, how this disease seems to be working, why it's affecting certain population groups, is one of the questions we're asking here and one of the things that should be viewed against the background of this history of human experimentation. Continuing now with A Higher Form of Killing. It is in the field of biological warfare that the most frightening possibilities present themselves. It is now nearly 30 years since Crick and Watson made their momentous discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, the molecule which controls heredity. The discovery has not yet, as far as is known, been applied to the business of war. But in the civilian laboratories of Europe and North America, biologists are regularly tampering with the nature of life itself through gene splicing or recombinant DNA. It has been called the most awesome discovery since man split the atom. Should the breakthrough, like atomic physics, come to be applied to warfare, the implications scarcely bear thinking about. As long ago as 1962, 40 scientists were employed at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories on full-time genetics research. Many others, it was said, appreciate the implications of genetics for their own work, unquote. That, by the way, is from a U.S. Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for fiscal year 62-63. Continuing, the implications were made more specific 7 years later when a Department of Defense spokesman claimed that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it is limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. And again, the next section here is from a U.S. House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for fiscal year 1969-70. And we're going to read you some of the complete text here in just a second. But listen to this statement very carefully. We're going to reread it a couple of times because this is one of the keys to the program. And again, from a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for Defense Appropriations 69 to fiscal year 69-70, within the next 5 to 10 years, and again, this is 1969, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. I'm going to read that one more time. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. Now, one of the keys here is the definition of the word refractory. Now, the word refractory in medicine means to be resistant to. In other words, to be resistant, what they're talking about here is developing a disease which would be resistant to the immunological and therapeutic processes which normally keep us healthy. Obviously, AIDS is certainly resistant to the immune system. Now, what's interesting is that the word refractory, another meaning of it, and specifically in physics and in biotechnology, the word refractory means to break down. A prism refracts light. It breaks it into its component spectra, and a refractory telescope, for example, does the same thing. Now, the person speaking these couple of sentences is a physician, so it may be that he was speaking in the medical sense, in which refractory means to be resistant to. On the other hand, he was referring to recombinant DNA, and in the context of biotechnology, refractory means to break down, as it does in physics. So whichever of the two definitions this doctor is using here, and ironically enough, perhaps the man's name was Dr. MacArthur, what we have here is something very, very close to the clinical definition of AIDS, only we have it in a House Appropriations Subcommittee for the Department of Defense for fiscal year 1969-70, almost a full decade before AIDS was reported, before AIDS appears to have been infiltrating the population. And again, we don't know whether refractory here means resistant to the immune system, as it does in conventional medicine, or break down, as it does in biotechnology or physics, but this is certainly an intriguing statement. As I said, practically the clinical definition of AIDS only many, many years before the fact, and coming from a Defense Department Appropriations hearing. Now, it's also interesting to note here how the authors, Paxman and Harris, follow this statement. They say, "The possibility that such a super germ may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside." And then that's sort of the key to the program this evening. We're going to take a look at that notion about whether that super germ was in fact made.
And whether in fact that germ is the one that's getting headlines these days, known as AIDS. This next section is a transcript of the Department of Defense Appropriations for 1970 from a hearing before a House Subcommittee on Appropriations. The man who is going to be talking here, the man who's going to be talking the most is going to be Dr. MacArthur, who is a chemical and biological warfare man from the Department of Defense, and Representative Sykes of Florida is the person who is questioning him. This is 1970, so this is about the same time as the other statement, and again, pay close attention to the time frame being talked about.
This is for 1970, so this is 1969. This is the hearing for 1970, and again, keep in mind the statement of Dr. MacArthur that they could do this within 5 to 10 years, and we're from 5 to 10 years from 69 is anywhere from, of course, 74 to 79.
Okay. Now, I believe MacArthur is speaking as this starts. He says, "There are two things about the biological agent field I would like to mention. One is the possibility of technological surprise. Molecular biology is a field that is advancing very rapidly, and eminent biologists believe that within a period of 5 to 10 years, again, this is the 1970 hearings, that within a period of 5 to 10 years, it would be possible to produce a synthetic biological agent, an agent that does not naturally exist and for which no natural immunity could have been acquired." Mr. Sykes, "Are we doing any work in that field?" Dr. MacArthur, "We are not." Mr. Sykes, "Why not? Lack of money or lack of interest?" Dr. MacArthur, "Certainly not lack of interest." Mr. Sykes, "Would you provide for our records information on what would be required, what the advantages of such a program would be, the time and the cost involved?" Dr. MacArthur. We will be very happy to. And then here's the information provided. The dramatic progress being made in the field of molecular biology led us to investigate the relevance of this field of science to biological warfare. A small group of experts considered this matter and provided the following observations. 1. All biological agents, up to the present time, are representatives of naturally occurring diseases and are thus known by scientists throughout the world. They are easily available to qualified scientists for research, either for offensive or defensive purposes. 2. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism, which could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. That's the statement Dave was reading before. Okay, and remember, refractory, meaning either to break down or to resist, depending in either way, basically very similar to what we're talking about when we're talking about the way that AIDS works. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. 3. A research program to explore the feasibility of this could be completed in approximately 5 years at a total cost of $10 million. 4. It would be very difficult to establish such a program. Molecular biology is a relatively new science. There are not many highly competent scientists in the field. Almost all are in university laboratories, and they are generally adequately supported from sources other than DOD, or Department of Defense. However, it was considered possible to initiate an adequate program through the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council, the NASNRC. The matter was discussed with the NASNRC, and tentative plans were made to initiate the program. However, decreasing funds in CB, growing criticism of the CB program, and our reluctance to involve the NASNRC in such a controversial endeavor have led us to postpone it for the past 2 years. It is a highly controversial issue, and there are many who believe such research should not be undertaken lest it lead to yet another method of massive killing of large populations. On the other hand, without the sure scientific knowledge that such a weapon is possible, and an understanding of the ways it could be done, there is little that can be done to devise defensive measures. Should an enemy develop it, there is little doubt that this is an important area of potential military technological inferiority in which there is no adequate research program. Okay, so essentially, again, the case being laid out, in this case, by Dr. MacArthur on behalf of the chemical and biological warfare people, the case being laid out for us back in 1970 to, at least officially and above board, to jump on the bandwagon and see if we can't whip up something like this to stay ahead of the Soviets.
It's also worth noting, too, that the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council was being tentatively explored in terms of serving as a vehicle to coordinate and assemble research being done in universities all around the country. Remember that, because that's going to sound very similar to something that we're going to be looking at in a second with regard to AIDS. Now, jumping to AIDS here for just a second, we're going to come back to the whole question of genetic engineering, recombinant DNA, and making a disease which would either break down or be resistant to the human... Let's say would confound the human immune system, whether by being resistant to it or by, in fact, attacking that very immune system, as AIDS has done. Let's proceed, and take a look at the actual discovery of the virus, which appears to be central to the AIDS question. And I use the term central because there are a number of different viruses that have been cropping up in connection with AIDS, and one of the questions that remains in researchers' minds is whether or not AIDS in and of itself may be the product of a number of different viruses acting together. But the main virus upon which research has centered is the so-called HTLV-3 or HTLV type 3 virus. An article about the discovery of that virus appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of April 17, 1984, just over 2 years ago. This is a Chronicle story by David Perlman, their science editor, headline, Variant of Virus Suspected in AIDS. researchers at the National Cancer Institute have isolated a variant of a cancer-associated virus from a group of AIDS patients and believe it may prove to be the cause of the epidemic in the gay community. Reports of the discovery circulated in medical circles all last week, but the chief of the research team in Bethesda, Maryland, Dr. Robert Gallo, G-A-L-L-O, insisted it was premature, unquote, to consider the virus as the agent that actually causes AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The organism, which is the third known variant of the human T-cell leukemia virus, is being termed HTLV type 3, skipping down in the article. The Gallo team discovered the first variant of the HTLV virus 4 years ago in a line of cells cultured from the lymph nodes of a patient with a cancer known as a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Since then, the same virus has been found in victims of a highly malignant lymphatic cancer that is particularly widespread in southwestern Japan, according to Dr. Irvin S.Y. Chen of the University of California at Los Angeles. A similar disease associated with the same virus is also common in several Caribbean countries. Skipping down again. The term T-cell refers to specialized cells that are formed in the bone marrow and organized in the thymus gland. They are vital to the normal functioning of the human immune system, and one of the major markers in AIDS patients is the disruption of their normal T-cell population. Molecular studies of the HTLV virus have shown that at its core of genetic material, that its core of genetic material carries what are known as oncogenes, unquote, segments of the genetic molecule believed to be cancer-causing. It also functions in the opposite manner from most viruses whose core is made up of DNA and therefore is termed a retrovirus. And skipping down again. Ever since researchers began seeking the cause of AIDS more than 3 years ago, a wide variety of viruses have been isolated from AIDS patients. Some scientists believe that when the cause of AIDS is found, it will turn out to be the combined action of several agents. A couple of points to make here. First of all, the HTLV type 3 virus was discovered in this country by the National Cancer Institute. That's very important. We're going to be talking about the National Cancer Institute and at considerable length here in just a second. Also note here that some scientists believe that AIDS may be the combination of a number of different agents acting together. This basically suggests a scenario which we're going to touch on again later called cross-vectoring, where basically you have a disease, in this case, perhaps hypothetically speaking, AIDS, which is produced by a number of different organisms acting together. In other words, say hypothetically, if it's four organisms, you could have three of the four and be fine, but it's when you get the fourth or activating vector that you would come down with the disease in question. That's one of the things being explored in connection with AIDS.
Okay, and before we get into the complicated subject of the genesis of the National Cancer Institute, the funding of various operations, and the ultimate disposition of Port and Down and Fort Detrick, places that we're going to be talking about tonight and that we've mentioned briefly already, we're going to take a break and give you a chance to get up and walk around and let some of these medical terms rattle down into their proper slots. And then we will return. Okay, so again, bear in mind what we've been talking about so far. We've gone through the transfer of the Project 731 Japanese Biological Warfare Program, which had actually been tested on, among others, American POWs and caused the deaths of many of them. And the direct transfer with no stop off in the middle, do not pass go, do not collect $200, but most importantly, do not go to jail. The passover directly into the United States and the establishment of that program into our biological warfare program at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and the virtually seamless continuation, including, among other things as we discussed, the testing of various other biological agents on unsuspecting and uninformed human populations. We also talked